This week's episode of the Star Wars Report podcast is brought to you by patreon.com/StarWarsReport. We thank everyone who's making this show happen and supporting it financially and also incidentally getting some cool bonus content along the way. You can join the team over at patreon.com/StarWarsReport, and we do appreciate everyone who's making the show happen. On with the show. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got a very special guest as we talk about the score behind Star Wars and much more on this week's podcast. Let's do it. It's the Star Wars Report podcast. Folks, I'm so excited to have this gentleman on. It's been far, 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 far too long, and I'm so glad to welcome back to the program Mr. David W. Collins. How's it going, David?
It's going very well, and thanks so much for inviting me to come on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to have you on this week, and we've got, man, there's so much to talk about in the world of Star Wars, as always. And of course, as I shouldn't forget, I'm your host, Riley. For those of you who are tuning in, there's always new folks each week, and we welcome you to the Star Wars Report. And we've got a lot of news. Of course, episode 8 officially filming. Rumors yeah. surrounding the Blu-ray release for The Force Awakens, and new Disney World Star Wars themed entertainment. And it's not what you think it is. But before we get to that, I want to talk to David and just kind of welcome you back. It's been far too long. In fact, I think we had you on right around the time that my favorite Star Wars niche podcast launched. That is Star Wars Oxygen. We had you around the time it began, far too long ago. And boy, has it, you guys have gone through now 4 films?
Well, actually, we've gone through 6.5.
That's true, because technically you have gone all the way through the prequels except Revenge of the Sith. And now you've gone through
Revenge of the Sith. Actually, I'd say we did about half of Revenge of the Sith. But yeah, we had to kind of cut it short just because The Force Awakens was looming large, and that's what was on everyone's minds. And I think, you know, there would have been a lynch mob coming after us if we didn't switch over to The Force Awakens as it came out. I mean, the amount of questions and tweets, I think.
And
honestly, yeah, I was so distracted myself. I had to switch to Force Awakens because of the new soundtrack.
Well, exactly. It's such a new flavor in so many ways, and it's so familiar in so many ways. And like I say, if you guys aren't familiar with it, Star Wars Oxygen is basically your Star Wars fan college course in John Williams. It is the things you thought you knew. If you think you know the Star Wars soundtracks in and out, ladies and gentlemen, you don't. That's why you have to listen to Star Wars Oxygen. I can't stress it enough because, David, I've come to really, really value the kind of insights that you bring because of your musical background. And for those who aren't familiar, we've certainly in the last few years, Star Wars, it turns out, David, Star Wars has kind of grown. So I'd love to tell us a little bit about yourself and your background when it comes to Star Wars, because you have a long history with the franchise.
Sure. Yeah. So I started working at Skywalker Sound in 1999 on their scoring stage, and then very quickly ended up working in the sound department at LucasArts in 2000. So for about 10 years, from 2000 to 2011, I worked on, so many Star Wars games. In fact, it's easier to mention which games I didn't work on than it is to mention which games I did, because I almost touched everything video game wise that came out in some form or another. Bigger contributions, of course, were Star Wars Republic Commando, Star Wars The Force Unleashed. I was the audio lead on both of those, and in The Force Unleashed, got to play Proxy the Droid. I was, my voice was in the Knights of the Old Republic games. I was the audio lead on Star Wars Battlefront 2. I worked on the Lego Star Wars, Indiana Jones, Monkey Island, all this Thrillville
games. David, don't sell yourself short, sir. Don't sell yourself short, because I want to also, like, the highlight, I'm sure, of your career was the opportunity to be featured in what Riley played ungodly hours and hours of, and that was Star Wars Battlefront Renegade Squadron as Darth Maul. Is this true?
Yes. I believe it's true. I mean,
it's on Wikipedia, so it's got to be true.
You know, I did Darth Maul in The Force Unleashed, but part of that was because, you know, they put Maul in the game and Proxy turns into Maul, and so it was mostly just kind of effort grunts and vocalizations. Renegade Squadron, I probably played Maul, but I don't know. I can't. I honestly, I wish I could remember. Renegade Squadron was made by Rebellion Studios, and so we did a lot of the dialogue for it. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it just got to the point where I was popping into the booth so much there. You know, hey, can you just grab this? I mean, there's a whole trailer. It's ironic because, you know, probably the biggest thing I've done to date is that I got to do a lot of character voices in the movie Star Wars: The Force Awakens.
Yes.
Right? So, getting a chance to do that and, you know, go up to Kylo Ren and say, "Sir, the droid was spotted heading west with a girl," you know, that whole thing. A bunch of other things. I think it was either Renegade Squadron or it was another one. There was a trailer. You could find a trailer online of just a bunch of stormtroopers, you know, under fire, all yelling at each other, and they're all me. You know, it was just like I did so much of that stuff back in the day that it's hard to remember.
It's funny because you always remember Star Wars with such fondness crystallized in when you were first introduced to it as a super fan, because usually everyone has the story of most everyone I've talked to on the podcast has a fan story of when they were introduced to it and then when they truly fell in love and became like the Star Wars uber nerd that they are today. And for me, like when I back in high school, early high school, when I purchased the original Sony PSP and was purchasing Star Wars games on it for the first time, I'll never forget. I can't even remember what game it was. It may have been the Battlefront game, because I don't remember the release order off the top of my head, but I remember distinctly there being a video trailer attached on this, yes, ladies and gentlemen, UMD disc. Taking off, gonna catch the world like firestorm.
Yeah. Yeah,
like fire across the galaxy, the UMD discs spread. No, that didn't happen, but they did have a trailer to The Force Unleashed that got me so excited about Star Wars, and the lead up to The Force Unleashed was such a big part of my Star Wars fandom, as I was introduced to this wide world beyond the films that I wasn't aware of.
Right. Yeah, I remember that time very well. So the PSP games that came out, the first one was Star Wars Battlefront 2, and that was 2005. That one I remember very well because we were testing on multiple consoles. I think it was PC, Xbox, PlayStation 2, and PSP for the first time. And I remember we announced that at E3. I think I put out a comlink video saying, "And we just announced at the show we're on the PSP." You know, I did like a little Battlefront flashback where I was demoing nice. Battlefront for people. If people want to find that on YouTube, they can. But that was out. And then I think after that was Renegade Squadron, which I think was probably 2008, maybe.
That sounds about
2007,
right.
2007, 2008?
I think it was like 2007 then, because we were expecting The Force Unleashed in 2008.
Yeah, and then Elite Squadron was after that, both of which were made by Rebellion Studios from the UK. I think those are the three Battlefront games that came out on PSP.
I apologize in some ways because I warned you guys we were going to get nerdy. I didn't realize we were going to get late 2000s mobile video gaming nerdy. But that's one of those things that I'll never forget. And a big part of your experience is your background in audio, and you have an amazing understanding of the realm of John Williams because of how much you've studied it in a way that while I'm a musician, I can appreciate your thoughts on it. I could never come up with your thoughts on the Star Wars score. So I'm excited to ask you a lot about it. But let's start with The Force Awakens real quick and
sure.
just say, because you've really been digging into episode after episode on Star Wars Oxygen, the minutiae, the detail, the connections to previous Star Wars scores. But speaking broadly, now that you've had time to really get comfortable and familiar with John Williams' latest score, what is your overall impression of the place that the Force Awakens score takes in the annals of Star Wars movie music?
I think that it's always going to be tough for anyone, at least my age, that grew up with the classic trilogy to kind of say that it'll have the same impact, only in that it now it's the seventh movie. Just by nature of being the seventh movie, it has so many other themes to carry. You know, how many times in The Force Awakens did we hear the Rebel fanfare? Did we hear the Force theme or Obi-Wan Kenobi's theme? Did we hear the main title theme? Did we hear Princess Leia, Han Solo, and the Princess? We heard all of those because we had to. And it was kind of a return to form. Excuse me. In that way, it's kind of a reprise. You know, it's kind of coming back to something that we're familiar with. And it had to do all of that work. You know, as opposed to Star Wars and then Empire Strikes Back, you know, it really was doing a lot of, it was breaking new ground. You know, there was no precedent, you know, and then on top of all that, it's got all these new elements in it. It's got this wonderful theme for Rey. Mm-hmm. It's got all these themes for Kylo Ren. It's got this wonderful resistance march in it. Scherzo for X-Wings. It's got a great cue for the Millennium Falcon, which I thought was great. You know, the monstrous music for the Rattars. You know, the sort of prequel callback for Snoke. I mean, there's just a lot that it's doing that it's almost so new, it's hard to zoom out and compare it to the other ones. One thing that I think is really interesting is I got to kind of monitor in real time about how long it takes to digest one of these things, because for the three prequel movies, I was working there for episode 2 and episode 3. So I was hearing music tracks before the movie came out, and we were cutting them into stuff like trailers and
oh wow.
Excuse me, a little under the weather here.
Oh, no worries.
But you know, episode 1, same thing. It just took a while for these to sink in. You know, but we've lived with them now for so long that it's been a nice reminder after 10 years of how long it takes to really appreciate the nuance, you know, on how many times do you have to see the movie before you know that theme without hearing it. You know, you'd be able to recall, like, okay, what is the theme for, you know, when Poe Dameron is flying, you know, with Finn out of the Star Destroyer, you know, how does that go? Oh yeah, it goes da 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 da, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I couldn't do that after the first 3 or 4 viewings. It took me, you know, several listens to the soundtrack and all that, because you're just taking in so much. I still think I'm in that process, and I think I would put it somewhere squarely in the middle, I guess, if I was forced to compare them all. It's not my favorite one, but it's certainly not my least favorite. I think there's some incredible, incredible music there.
Indeed. And it's interesting because that's so true when it comes to processing new Star Wars material overall. Exactly my experience with the score has been my experience with The Force Awakens as a film, because it is a distinctly visual style that's different from anything we've seen before in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And in the same way, the music is a distinctly different style. But I did really enjoy it. And in fact, we had for like an initial sort of overall reaction to the score, we had a composer of Battlefront, Gordy Hab, on the program.
And, oh, good.
And he was great, because he really kind of broke down some of the familiarities with John Williams' previous music. But that was only the beginning. We're really just now kind of getting used to what's new. And that's what I love about it. And so if you had to say, I think Rey's theme is obviously the immediate standout. But yes. If I were to have you just kind of pull out what you think is the best, most recognizable theme, with the exception of Rey, because I think that's sort of the obvious standout. Is there one that's really jumped out to you that you find yourself going back to?
I think Kylo Ren would be the first answer, because he's got...
Which of his three?
Well, exactly. First of all, you know, finding and identifying that he's got three, right? Mm-hmm. And still tying those in. And they're also not really themes. They're just phrases. So where are those is going to go, and how are they going to tie together? I mean, one of the things that intrigues me is you know, how is John Williams planting seeds for IT-9, mm-hmm. right? You know, how is that going to compare? I mean, in the way, you know, Duel of the Fates was a seed that was planted, you know, for 2 and 3. What exactly is happening here? You know, I mean, one of the things that I noticed almost immediately about the score is that there's almost no human voice in the score. You know,
that's true.
With the exception of Snoke's track, there's no big chorale.
Which is something very odd, so after, especially for someone like me who's from the prequel generation, who's used to Battle of the Heroes and Duel of Fates.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just because that was very fashionable in the 90s. If you were in the 90s, you know, every time you went to a movie theater and you saw a trailer, they were cutting in, you know, Carmina Burana and big choral stuff, you know, and I don't know if it was just fashion for 99 and then carrying it into 2005, or if it was just because he wanted to give it a little bit more of a weighty, almost religioso force, to quote George Lucas, feeling.
I remember that, and I'm trying to remember, based on the Phantom Menace documentary, the great making of that features John Williams talking about Duel of Fates, where I remember them talking about how it was brand new territory. But was that a George thing, or was that a John Williams thing for bringing in choir to the world of Star Wars?
Well, John Williams said when he was spotting the movie with George, he said I think the phrase that he used was, you know, he wanted it to feel like they were in a giant temple, that it was something sacred happening. And he said, and so I thought a chorus would be just the thing, I think he said. In an interview. So I thought, well, of course, it'd be just the thing, you know. And then he went into talking about how he chose the text and the language and all of that. But it does give it that kind of almost sacred, ancient feeling, you know.
Oh,
and
indeed
part
it does.
Of that, I think, is you know, for prequel, it's part of the prequels in general. Is like going back in time, you know.
No, absolutely, and it gets that feeling. So it's interesting to see, maybe as we move forward and learn a little bit more about maybe Snoke, or how the First Order began, or what their origin is, and what's their influence outside of just the old Empire. Because I have a feeling we don't know everything when it comes to the First Order, and there's a lot to learn about its radical origin. And I wouldn't be surprised if we get some, maybe a little bit more of a return later to some of the more prequel-sounding choral pieces. And I would definitely, as you know, a huge fan of Howard Shore, and even Hans Zimmer's work, while certainly different, they both do use vocals a whole lot, and that is something that I think John Williams is a little bit more reserved about, which I think is a good thing.
You mean in Episode 7, or just in general as a composer?
In general as a composer, because if you think about it, I'm rolling through mentally through the soundtracks, but really it's only Episode 1 and Episode 3 that really have strong choral pieces, with one notable exception, of course, Return of the Jedi. When Luke faces Vader, which is my favorite moment of the entire original trilogy score.
Right. Oh, yeah. Really, really powerful, very operatic moment. There's a little bit in Episode 2. I mean, and he has other scores that use chorus, you know, used quite a bit for Temple of Doom. You know, I think of Home Alone. I think of...
Oh, that's true. That's true.
A few others. I think of Hook. You know, there's a few out there. But yeah, I mean, certainly when it came to Star Wars, the classic trilogy, there was a little bit of a woman's choir in Empire Strikes Back, very, very little, buried in the mix on the way to Cloud City. And then, of course, the operatic voices for the dark side, the Emperor, and then the big finale. Mm. But yeah, I mean, Episode 7 kind of established its own language there, you know, with Rey and Kylo Ren. You know, I think that our opinion will change as we go along.
Yes.
I mean, I think that happens with all Star Wars, with all art, really. I mean, you know, there's that always that moment in between when you don't know what's going to happen next, you know, and then you do find out what happens next. You watch the next movie or the next episode of the Clone Wars or whatever it is, and it completely changes the way you see the episode or film before it.
No, it's so true. It's so true. And in fact, this very podcast has been... if you just go back to the last, I don't know, what is it, middle of February? Just go back to the last 8 weeks of the lead up to and the reaction from The Force Awakens, even just over the course of 2 months, is just this incredible seesaw of emotions that we've all, it's interesting because so many fans have experienced before when it comes to the prequels or even the original trilogy generation. But for me, truly, as far as a theatrical experience, I and many others are going through this for the first time with The Force Awakens, which I've come to, there have been parts of the journey that are a little bit heartbreaking at times, and then there are other parts that are joyful. It's really the full circle.
Right. Yeah, as someone that has now lived through this for a second time, you know, being kind of in the generation that I remember seeing Return of the Jedi in the theaters as a very, you know, as a little kid with my grandfather and my parents, and then going through the prequels as a young adult, and a college student, and then, you know, working there. It's interesting to go through it yet again, because, you know, I feel like it's kind of done something to the whole classic / prequel divide, because now there's just more to talk about. Because my hope is, anyway, that people that, you know, just roll their eyes at prequel haters and people that are classic trilogy diehards, find some, and and maybe don't like the prequels, find some common ground when it comes to these new movies. Because I think what's going to happen is, you know, people who are of the prequel generation and find themselves struggling upon first or second viewing with The Force Awakens will maybe have a little bit more sympathy for the shock to the system that truly was The Phantom Menace. It really was a shock to the system the first time I saw it.
That's true.
You know, now, you know, I just, those movies are so deep and so rich and so filled with so many things to love. But it was just so incredibly different, you know, and now it's kind of true with a J.J. Abrams style movie versus, sorry, the dog's playing with a squeak toy.
Oh, no, actually, in fact, David, I was about to interrupt and say, are you on a Foley stage? I'm suspicious that you're on a Foley stage.
No, I've got a little dog that's chasing me around with a squeak toy Chewbacca.
Nice.
So yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, just kind of monitoring in ourselves as fans how we take in new stuff, new material has been fascinating. Because these movies were such huge and rare, like pillars of the earth, you know, and now we're going to get five more, you know, starting with The Force Awakens. So like it's interesting to kind of monitor how everyone feels about it, you know, because I've seen people that are, you know, prequel generation that have grown up with it and just kind of don't know about this. You know, and I've seen classic trilogy people going, yeah, this is what I'm talking about. You know? But I've also seen the opposite of that. You know, I've just seen it across the board. I think most people have responded to the new movie really positively, as I did. But I think, you know, Star Wars used to be like every single frame scrutinized, but now it's becoming a bit more of a numbers game, which is what I like to say about Star Trek. Trek, to me, has always been a numbers game, because if you start out watching the original series, or you start out watching The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine, really hard to get. But by the time they get to season, you know, 2, 3, 4, whatever, and they're making some of the most forgettable TV, it's incredible. Well, that's starting to happen with Star Wars, right? Where it's like, if you don't like one of the movies, so what? You've got like, you're going to have like 10 others to watch that you're going to love, you know, because it's so broad. I'm just kind of a mega fan, so I love it all.
No, it's true. It's become more and more of a buffet in a way that I'm really excited about. And like, if you didn't like The Force Awakens, well, guess what? You have a Star Wars war movie coming this December, right?
Exactly.
If you don't like that, you've got a heist movie coming up, you know, and that's what's exciting about theatrical Star Wars, because theatrical Star Wars has always been sort of a fairly mainstream, familiar, linear, family-oriented story, and now I guess it was the expanded universe, and now stuff that's beyond the films that used to explore those other territories. But now, and frankly, I think Clone Wars and now Rebels are kind of leading the way with that, of experimenting with Star Wars and other story formats, whether it be horror or romance or something like that, action adventure. Now it turns out actual full-length films are going to make that leap too. Hello.
One of the reasons why I've always been, hello, can you hear me?
There's a little bit of a crunch and a delay, but I think we can hear you now.
Okay, sorry about that. I think one of the reasons why I've been so forgiving and very just sort of patient with any and all things Star Wars is because I worked on a lot in the expanded universe. You know, that was kind of what we did, is we told expanded universe stories and made games. And I worked on some games that I'm very proud of, and I worked on other games that I thought, well, gosh, this isn't really good, but I'm gonna make it sound great. You know, like you know, we were like just spitting them out every year. We were putting out a couple of different games, you know, sometimes we had these giant pillars, but sometimes it was like, oh, we're putting that out as well. Okay, well, you know, like you know, there was a demand for it. I feel like the same is true with the novels. I feel like the same is true with the comic books. There's just so much Star Wars, and you know, I think it's disingenuous to say, you know, that all of it's amazing, and that you love every single thing, you know, because then you'd have to include like the holiday special and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, like, you know, I think there's room for a lot of experimentation. And I think that, you know, to quote my friend Sam Witwer, he said, you know, the problem with Star Wars is that everyone thinks they know Star Wars. And you know what? Everyone's right. They do, you know, because it means so much to many different
Some people like the love story. Some people like the mythos of it. Some people like the action and the explosion. Some people are just love these big visual effects films, you know. Some people like the politics. It's all in there. It's just so broad.
Wow. You know? It's funny because what you're communicating is something that I guess when I did a nightly countdown, because yes, I'm that nerdy, podcast leading to The Force Awakens, a guest of ours and a good friend of mine, Justin Robert Young, made that point very well, because he despises the prequels and doesn't mind saying so. But I think I kind of won him over, at least to the generational effect of, like, even if you don't love the movies or you don't think they're great, if that's what you grew up with and the first time you saw freaking Darth Maul ignite two lightsabers, you thought it was the coolest thing you'd ever seen. Like,
oh, yeah.
I feel like I was able to at least communicate the, I guess, the positional argument, if not the quality argument. But he's very much of the same mind, where Star Wars is different things to different people, and that's what makes it so special. And that's why I'm excited that we're getting these different themes for the various films. But man, I feel like this is some of the best discussion we've had about Star Wars in the post TFA universe yet. So I'm glad we're able to have it, for sure.
Oh, good. Yeah. But, yeah. I love The Force Awakens. I've seen it 8 times. I'm still dying to go see it again before it leaves theaters.
And, oh, you beat me. I'm only at 7, sir.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's just a lot to take in. And I want to see it one more time and get back in with those characters. And it's also strange to be doing a music podcast about something that I'm digesting and analyzing live on the air kind of at the same time.
Yep.
You know, because with all the other movies, I'm able to, you know, there's years of listening to it and actually physically working with it at LucasArts to draw on. And with this, I don't have that. It's really just, let's just take it in. And one of the exciting things about that it's added to the show is this kind of sense of community. You know, we get a lot of emails where people go, hey, did you hear this? Did you hear that? You know, and it's been great for me because it lets me know that A, I'm not crazy and overanalyzing this, and B, that, you know, we have an audience of Star Wars fans that are just so passionate about music and are some of the smartest, most like perceptive people in the world, I swear. I mean, they just, you know, the emails that we get are just like, did you pick up on this? Did you pick up on this? And it's like, yep. This is great. This is awesome. You know, really, really great. Always talking with Star Wars fans because they always bring a lot to the table.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And allow me to be that nerd right now, Mr. David Collins, because I come prepared. Yeah, we can talk about the great vastness and variety of the Star Wars universe. And we can wax philosophical about how we think it's become more and more inclusive and exciting as Star Wars fans. Or Riley could ask David Collins something that's been bugging him about the Revenge of the Sith score for, I want to say, years. I think it's been years at this point that I've noticed this moment. And of course, one thing I didn't know and I've learned through listening through Star Wars Oxygen is that, especially the prequel scores, there is so much missing music from the soundtracks. If you buy a Star Wars soundtrack, there is so much material beyond what's in that CD in the film itself. And that's something that it's really fascinating to listen. And so, David, not too long ago, I was talking about this on the shows about a year ago, maybe a little bit more, and a listener who shall remain unnamed sent me his copy of the Revenge of the Sith, well, actually all three prequel soundtracks cue by cue. So instead of the traditional soundtrack, it's each film cue. I believe, and again, I asked no questions. I simply thanked him for the gift. But it's, I believe, taken, I'm imagining, from a rather complex rip of the film and then divided cue by cue. And so that's sort of the platform. And I have so many questions, but I'll just get to the specific one first. And I have my audio prepared, sir. You'll be proud of me. I just have to make sure my player works here. But so for Revenge of the Sith, one of the cues that... and the reason I feel like I need to give a brief background, but one of the reasons this has bothered me for so long and that I've been curious about this for so long is that this was a moment that that I cried like, a 15-year-old kid cries when he sees Revenge of the Sith and is way more into it than most of his friends. And that was right at the hour and 43 minute mark and 20 seconds in Revenge of the Sith. You get a really, really touching moment. In fact, I've cued it a little bit early. It's a little bit difficult to get to the exact spot, but it's right here when Padme is landing on Mustafar to confront Anakin about his transgressions. And I'm going to pipe this up for just a little bit here. So, of course, you're going to hear the audio, but as it lands, you're going to hear Q fade in. That's very familiar as she lands. And it's... Revenge of the Sith is so fast-paced, and it's sort of like a giant steel ball of dark side energy that just rolls down the mountain, fatefully colliding towards the birth of Darth Vader. And you know it's happening. You know the Titanic's going to sink. But there's this brief moment that when I was watching the film, the last thing I'm thinking about is Anakin and Padme rolling around on the meadows on Naboo. But when she lands and just takes that brief moment and this lingering shot, this unusually long shot that just takes a pause from the action after, you know, Anakin's just slaughtered all of them Nemoidians. And you hear the fade in of the love theme from Attack of the Clones. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, this cue is not in the soundtrack, but I thought, aha, I'm going to go to my trusty cue-by-cue breakdown soundtrack. And I was reading a little bit about this in the Wikipedia entry, and they have this listed by, I want to make sure I get this right, what they call, and you, actually this is the first place I'll get you to help me out a little bit, David, what they call each of the slate, title, and recording dates. So for what is the difference in terms of the slate and title? They have things listed like 1M or, you know, something more along the lines of, mm-hmm. you know, 7M8, that sort of thing.
Right.
What 1M8, is that?
1M5, right. That would be real 1, music Q5. Real gotcha. 2, music Q2, that sort of thing.
Okay, so as I... R2-D2.
That's where R2-D2 got his name.
Exactly.
Right? Real 2, dialogue 2, yep.
So in the cue itself, I'm actually gonna just jump to that real quick and pull that up. It's called Padme's Visit, 6M3. And if I jump about 15 seconds, this is as she lands. But it cuts right there into this nice traditionally, it doesn't sound edited to me, we'll do it right here. You do not hear right there the fade in of the moment that made 15-year-old Riley cry, the beautiful love theme, hearkening to what might have been. And so, help me out, David. Is this something that would have been recorded at a separate time? Was it taken from Attack of the Clones? You are now my John Williams detective, and I'm shamelessly quizzing you on the show here.
I am 90% sure that that was taken from Attack of the Clones.
Okay.
Or taken from a different part of the movie. That's also a possibility. Basically, my understanding of how this worked, just from a practical point of view, John Williams, George Lucas, Rick McCallum fly to London in February of 2005. The movie doesn't come out until May, right? ILM's still cranking away. Skywalker Sound's still cranking away. Ben Bird is still cutting the movie. They fly out there with the movie in whatever state it's in by February, right? 4 months out.
Yep.
And they... After John Williams has been writing to, you know, whatever he possibly could, you know, over the last couple of months, few months, maybe longer, they go and they record the London Symphony Orchestra for a week or two, you know, flying from Los Angeles and San Francisco, respectively, all the way out to London, right? Getting over the jet lag, whatever it is, recording where they record. They come back, they mix it, it goes in. John Williams being very busy, the movie being, you know, on a very tight schedule, and Ken Wanberg, the editor, having to do a lot of edits on Attack of the Clones and then again on Revenge of the Sith. As the picture changes happen and as George wants to make changes, which he did quite a bit in post-production, as we all know, those are music edits that are made with whatever material they can presumably find, right? So,
okay.
My take is that, you know, on that Q2Q, which I am aware of, We don't really cover it on the show because it's not an official release, but it has been floating around. It has been sent to me as well.
Gotcha.
It really is a good tool to kind of detect, oh, well, this is different.
Right? Yeah.
What I haven't done, and we haven't gotten this far in the show, what I haven't done is and looked at, well, let me see if I can go. And usually on the show to prep for Star Wars Oxygen, what I'll do is I'll like look at that moment. Then I'll go back.
Okay.
You know, a moment like that is late in the film. We haven't talked about the end of the film at all. Then I would go back and I would just, or I can find it elsewhere. And usually you can find it somewhere. You know, a really long kind of drawn out version of Attack of the Clones like that. The love theme from Attack of the Clones like that. It makes me think that it's coming from the other one. I doubt it was a score pickup date. In other words,
gotcha.
It gets a little more complicated in that we don't have any commercially released version of Attack of the Clones. There, you know, even this Q2Q, like a lot of the Q2Q stuff, some of it is edited, some of it isn't, but it's hard to tell where the source came from and how reliable it is unless you're hearing music edits in there. So it's basically what I'm telling you, Riley, is when it comes to the prequels, it's a little bit of a tricky mess. One of the sites that I use a lot, because mm-hmm. there's a lot of fans out there that have done a lot of this work, is jwfan.com.
Ah, yes, I've heard
of
it.
And there are people that listen to Oxygen that are regular contributors of that website. I've used it pretty liberally in doing research, a lot of times just to kind of make sure that, you know, I'm not crazy, and just to try and verify what my findings are. Millions of people listen to this music, so... you know, I want to make sure that we're staying on target, so to speak.
No, absolutely.
But my opinion is I'm 90% sure that that is not a score pickup. That if it did not come from earlier in the movie, which I also probably doubt, it probably came from Attack of the Clones, and it was an editorial decision by George.
Interesting. Yeah. And it proves why he's such a good editor, because it's such an important moment in the film.
Yeah.
That you just you can't leave a moment like that behind. And like, I just want to play it again real quick. Let's take a quick listen one more time. Even the entire time you hear that, the love cue, it's just a close-up of Padme. Man, Natalie Portman. People give her a hard time for some of her acting and delivery, but I don't think anything can be argued about her performance in the final act of Revenge of the Sith. And in fact, I've always often made the point about Revenge of the Sith, and that in terms of the final act of that film, I dare you to put any modern actors up against the performance of Hayden Christensen and Ewan McGregor and Natalie Portman in that film.
It's a fantastic film. In fact, I often find myself secretly thinking when people say that they don't like Revenge of the Sith, I'm like, you know, you really should watch that movie again. And I think that critics of Revenge of the Sith are critics of Revenge of the Sith because of Attack of the Clones. Like I've often said to people, I said, you know, a lot of people's biggest problem with Revenge of the Sith is Attack of the Clones. You know. Mm. Because if you walked into that movie cold and you've got a problem with the meadow scene, or you've got a problem with the, I hate sand, it's coarse and it gets everywhere, or you got a problem with, you know, the kiss becomes a scar, or you got a problem with I truly, deeply, whatever your problem is with the love story in that movie, okay, fine. But, like, it's really good in Revenge of the Sith. It just kind of stands on its own, you know, which is why I think the machete order of you know, watching Star Wars was born. People like to go 4, 5, 3, 6, you know.
Yeah, no, we did that as an experiment with someone who had never seen it right here on this very podcast last year. And man, that was a fun experience.
It's really fun. And I had a friend that did it as well. And he said that when the birth of the twins was revealed in 3, it was, I mean, he jumped out of his chair when you know, she said Leia,
after Luke, you know, the whole twin moment was a huge revelation. And then when he finally watched Return of the Jedi, and Alec Guinness is going, well, I told you sort of from a certain point of view, and well, the other one you spoke of is your sister. Leia's my sister. You're right. Your insight says you well. He was like, he turned and he said, wait, this is how the world found out about this? That's so lame compared to Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, no, it's a different way of experiencing the films for sure. And again, I appreciate. I was not exactly sure the direction because it was such an open ended question. And I appreciate your insight, sir. And it'll be interesting. Maybe that'll put you on the hunt to actually. Again, ladies and gentlemen, this is just Riley's ignorant. Please, sir, tell me this. So if you want to really hear an in-depth analysis of Revenge of the Sith score, it should be Star Wars Oxygen, and you guys are going to finish the film soon. So maybe, I don't know, that'll put you on the hunt, perhaps.
If you know, feel free to tweet at me at David W. Collins if I'm wrong. If one thing that Star Wars fans have taught me is to be very humble, and I am certainly I am not infallible, to use a double negative. it comes up and you know, we make mistakes sometimes, but we just try and do the best we can. And to my knowledge, that was the, I answered your question to the best of my knowledge, but it does make me want to go back and check everything out one more time.
Yeah, because it is a unique, I didn't immediately recognize the love theme cue because you're right, it is very drawn out, and that might be a sort of processing of some kind. It'd be interesting to see where it comes from. But it just goes to show that sort of really heavy editing process that Star Wars is known for. Even The Force Awakens, that went through so many periods of edits and
there are
story.
A lot of music edits in The Force Awakens, too. You know, my understanding is that, there were a lot of picture changes. And the nice thing about John Williams recording in L.A., and, you know I talk about this a lot, but just it's a very practical, creative consideration that you've got Bad Robot 5 or 6 miles from the Sony scoring stage.
That's true.
You know, I mean, that's a big deal, you know, and the fact that they could just, well, let's get the team back together and we're going to go back in for one more pickup date.
Indeed. Know? That's so true.
That was something that that didn't get to happen a lot in the previous six films.
Yeah, no, and that's something that hopefully they'll be able to do moving forward as well. And you know, we know that Star Wars Episode 8 is on its way, but I won't tease it enough. David, you want to hit a few news stories with me?
Sure.
Let's do it.
We have something to report.
Delta, I have good news.
Data brought to us by the Bothan spies.
We can send a clear transmission.
There it is. Listen.
I just wanted to hit a couple quick news stories. Primarily, actually, of course, Episode 8's underway. Everyone's tweeting about it, Snapchatting about it. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you're not following John Boyega on Snapchat, it is the best thing ever. Like, if you want to see him partying it up with a BAFTA award, follow John Boyega on Snapchat. It is the best thing ever.
That's awesome.
What I wanted to touch on today was actually an interesting little thing that I saw in an interview. I'm trying to remember the source who is from The Hollywood Reporter, but the co-producer of Star Wars The Force Awakens, who's Ben Rosenblatt, revealed something interesting about the final shot of the film. Of course, the famous helicopter shot that we see at the end of The Force Awakens. In fact, in an interview, he admitted that J.J. Abrams was conflicted about using the shot. He was trying to decide between that and a close-up of Rey, and added, though, that the decision was driven by, you guessed it, David, John Williams' score. He, quote, "It left you with a sweeping, emotional, epic feel." And you're going to see a lot of that in Episode 8. So, ladies and gentlemen, I really think it's interesting because I have heard passionate hatred of that shot. You'd be surprised, but like, it definitely took some getting used to. But I liked it. It's that epic Lord of the Rings style shot that you are used to seeing sweeping over the mountains of New Zealand. But in the case of Star Wars, I think it works. Because, you know, The Force Awakens, as much homage as it pays to the original trilogy, I mean, if you think about it, it structurally and in terms of story, with the almost cliffhanger ending, I mean, I think it's fair to call it a cliffhanger, where, boom, there's Luke Skywalker, and we're out. Drop the mic. Walk away. It's a very different type of ending to something like A New Hope, the first of the original trilogy, and something very unlike The Phantom Menace, the first of the prequel trilogy. It definitely, instead of just kind of maybe alluding to a future threat, like Sidious in episode 1 or Darth Vader's escape in episode 4. In this case, it's a very clear, here we are, I'm going to be training Kylo Ren, and here's Rey, and she's going to be training with Luke. That's the implication. So it's a different ending, and I think in that context it works. Where were you on, what's your up or down on the final shot, David?
It took some getting used to. I've heard the same thing. Sorry, I've got planes flying overhead. I'm normally in my studio, but it's down at the moment. So I'm kind of going between inside and outside here.
Oh, no worries, no worries.
But anyway,
is it J.J. Abrams filming helicopter getting a nice aerial shot of David Collins staring loftily off into the distance?
Yes, exactly.
Handing out his microphone saying, will you podcast with me?
exactly. I was so caught up by the moment of that shot it's not even something that I really thought about until maybe the second time I saw it. Or the third time, maybe, but it was definitely different. You know, I felt like that scene just went on a little too long, and it's probably because there was the music was scored to whatever version John Williams saw and wrote to it, and then once it was done, he loved the music, so he left it in. That's cool, I think that. I think that that whole scene had a huge emotional impact the first time I saw it. And I think that that's really the reaction that I hold on to the strongest, the first time you see thing, I feel like you need to kind of always kind of keep that in mind in terms of when you're a Star Wars fan, you can overanalyze everything, but what was the emotional impact going in cold? And
Indeed. It's
really hard to do with Star Wars nowadays because we're so young when we saw these movies that we don't even remember seeing them for the first time. We just remember repeat viewings and falling in love, right? But this was a huge media event. We all jumped in and watched it. Interesting for me is that, sorry?
Oh, no, I was just going to add, and I feel like maybe overanalyzed it a bit. I'm not even going to say maybe. For me personally, experiencing this film for the first time the way I did, under the circumstances I did, I definitely am totally guilty of that. And I think that's something that I don't know if it's possible, but my intention moving forward is to really personally not lower expectations for the quality of the film, but lower expectations for what I think is necessary for a good Star Wars film and be more open to the new visual language.
Yeah, well, and like you can never win. If you want the same visual language, then it's a carbon copy. If you want new visual language, then they're not being true to the franchise. Mm-hmm. So it's yeah. There's a tricky balance
it's
there.
True. We're terrible. It's really hard to please Star Wars fans.
I'll give you another really great quote from Sam that he once said to me in an interview, which is, the advice he gave all of us going into The Force Awakens was watch the movie they're giving you, not the movie in your head.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's another way of just saying, temper your expectations and go in and just, take it for what it is. It's definitely something I really fell into with The Phantom Menace,
Mm-hmm.
It took me years of just going, well, this is like actually really fun, but it wasn't what I was expecting as a classic trilogy fan, and a lot of people just kind of held on to that like a grudge as opposed to like, well, this is really awesome,
Mm-hmm. Embrace your inner happening. Riley who just saw Darth Maul's lightsaber and went, that's the coolest thing ever.
Exactly. Although I have to tell you, when I saw that double-bladed lightsaber in a trailer, I lost my mind.
Oh, yeah?
I was much older. Oh, yeah. I still thought the Darth Maul fight was perfect. Upon first viewing, I just thought it was incredible.
Little did you know, David, that the defining role of your career would be playing Darth Maul in Battlefront Renegade Squadron.
At least to you. but what's interesting about The Force Awakens, getting back to it, is that when I worked on it on the ADR stage, I saw a lot of it. And, it was in black and white. Visual effects weren't done and there was no sound. And, because of that, I went into The Force Awakens, I think, with a sense of confidence that I knew what I was going to be in for. But I really didn't, because they hid Luke Skywalker from us. They hid, the tragedy of Han Solo from us. We didn't know any of that when mm-hmm. we worked on it. They hid those scenes.
Wow.
you know, that's and amazing. they hid, you know, some really nice reveals so that it was still a fun surprise. And of course, for those of you that tune into StarWars.com, I was one of the co-hosts of the red carpet at the Hollywood premiere. And that same night is the first time I saw the movie. So we did the red carpet and then everyone went into their respective theaters. Just to paint a picture of this, this was a record breaking premiere for Hollywood. The red carpet was 3 city blocks long. And the premiere took place in 3 theaters. It was not just the Dolby Theater where they did the Oscars, but it was also the El Capitan, you know, a la the 2011 Muppet movie, and the Chinese, right, where it originally opened in 1977. Uh-huh. And I went and saw it at the Dolby, you know, sitting next to my co-hosts, Andy Gutierrez and Tony Carboni. And everyone was there. J.J. Abrams, Kathy Kennedy, the cast, everyone.
It was amazing. Like, just watching the stream was incredible.
Yeah. And so I'm in there and watching the movie like that. It just, I didn't see Han Solo's death coming. I didn't see it coming, which seems so silly in retrospect. I didn't see it coming. I didn't see the Luke thing coming. I just watched it like with my mind just totally blank. And it's because I was exhausted and cold and I'd been on my feet for a long time and, you know, just had the adrenaline pumping from having worked the red carpet and met Andy Serkis and Lupita Nyong'o and, you know, everybody that came through.
You were not unlike C-3PO on Hoth saying, "My joints are about to freeze up."
That's exactly right. Yeah, I was pretty much frozen. My feet were tired. I was so happy to be sitting down. I was so happy to be there that I just had an incredible experience. So the Skellig Michael helicopter shot didn't bother me the first time in any stretch of the imagination. I was just so happy when that movie was over. And I remember walking out and seeing Pablo Hidalgo and his wife, Kristen, and they're like, and no one wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, we just wanted to just soak it in. There's just too much to talk about it. Everyone just left like just quiet and smiling, just like, wow, you know, mm-hmm. because there was just too much to talk about. It's like, you know what? Don't ruin it by talking about it. Just let it sink in. We just saw a new Star Wars movie. You know,
wow, that's so true. That's the way, ladies and gentlemen, that's the way it should be done. That's the way it should be done. Absolutely. Wow. Yeah. Well, and I also want to touch on another story here. This is from Jedi News, and we do have some early rumors now. This is from Blu-ray.com that the Force Awakens Blu-ray set is going to have a 3-disc set, which makes me very excited. The most interesting thing here is that we may have a possible release date that looks like possibly in April, but it's not confirmed yet. We're still waiting to hear officially, but it's looking right. Like we may be a little over maybe a month and some change to actually being able to finally get a beautiful high-definition physical copy of The Force Awakens, which makes me very happy.
What do you want out of a Blu-ray release, Riley?
You know, I am not a big home video guy, which is funny because I love watching movies with friends, but I'm actually a big movie theater guy. I love going to the theater. And so when it comes to a Force Awakens Blu-ray, I probably have to say that it's probably not as big of a deal for me as it is for others. My biggest, what I'm really hoping we get is some really good behind-the-scenes documentary. Very similar to the extended edition of Lord of the Rings. I really, really absolutely loved the material from the extended Lord of the Rings films as far as bonus content goes. And frankly, the amazing behind-the-scenes documentary that we got with The Phantom Menace, I'm hoping that we get a little bit more behind-the-scenes than, say, we did for Attack of the Clones or Revenge of the Sith. That's kind of my big thing when it comes to the Blu-ray.
I agree. You know, I watch movies on Blu-ray, but I'm such a behind-the-scenes junkie.
Yes.
That my favorite Blu-ray or DVD feature of all time is my favorite Blu-ray and the most impactful Blu-ray or sorry, DVD I ever got was Episode One, The Phantom Menace.
Yes.
By you know, without a doubt. I mean, they set a new standard for what DVD releases could be with that documentary, The Beginning, that you brought up earlier. If we got something like that, oh, could you imagine?
Please. And I like the linear kind of behind the scenes because, and I think the segments that were done, like the web segments and that sort of thing, or for both Revenge of the Sith and Attack of the Clones, were really cool. But I really do like to see the full sort of linear picture of the making of the film. And I don't think they would shy away from it. We've already seen, in terms of the art of the Force Awakens book, a lot of the iterations that the film went through. So I would like to kind of see that in a full behind the scenes documentary.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Absolutely. And then I'm going to make this, I could talk about an original film print of Star Wars being restored and released. But guess what? Riley doesn't care.
Really?
I'm one of those people, man. I've never seen the theatrical cut of Star Wars. Never. I've done this podcast for nearly 4 years, and I've never seen the original cut, and not the Laserdisc rip off of the 2004 DVD either. And I'm one of those people that I really think. Maybe I'm poisoned. I might be poisoned, David, because the arguments made in favor of restoring it, if you can make the historical film preservation argument, I can become more sympathetic. But if you can go from the age 16 to 19, falling in love with the world of Star Wars, and the only thing you ever hear about the original cut of the film is how terribly George Lucas ruined it and all of Star Wars forever, It's hard to get your mind on the side of those folks. So, well, I don't know. Let me ask you, we'll touch on this briefly. I have it in the notes here. So there's this, and it is a really interesting project, and maybe I haven't given it its fair shake. So, David, what do you know about it? You tell me, is this something that I should, as a Star Wars fan, appreciate and be excited about?
Well, that's a great question. First of all, it is a huge controversy. I certainly understand where you're coming from. I think that the special editions made a huge impact, and I think that George made a lot of tremendous improvements to the movie, especially, you know, in the end of Star Wars. There was this really great shot, actually a few shots added to the trench run, the space battle there, that just blew me away when I saw it in theaters in 97. Mm-hmm. I think that George Lucas is rare in that he didn't go the route that a lot of people have gone, which is, well, here's this version and here's that version. Here's the director's cut and here's the original theatrical release. And he is unique in that way. And a lot of fans who fell in love with something don't get to see what they fell in love with. It's like, I guess the only way to really make people understand it is if in 2017, Disney put out, it's hard now because it's all in HD.
I was going to say, because I'm the guinea pig. I'm the example. I'm the person that you need to sell this to in terms of what original cut means.
Okay, so let's say that they put out a version, Disney puts out a version of, or let's say it was still George, puts out a version of The Phantom Menace in 2017, and it looks and sounds better than it ever did, and that's great. But suddenly, Jar Jar is speaking an alien language with subtitles, or Darth Maul has a third blade that comes out, or they add the tri-blade from The Force Awakens into Maul's saber or into Qui-Gon's saber or something like that. And you appreciate that, but you also have this emotional thing at your core from your childhood that made you buy a ticket to this new version in the first place that you want to see, you know? Mm-hmm. And for someone like me, I actually really appreciate both. I actually don't agree with the decision to not release the originals. It's probably the only thing that I don't agree with George Lucas on. I think that, and part of this is because in 1988, he stood up in Washington, D.C. and told...
Yeah, famously.
Famously, you know, hey, Ted Turner's going to colorize and ruin all these movies. These need to be preserved. You know, I like the preservation angle of that. And I think that's always valid. But I think even more so, a movie that is as culturally important as Star Wars, that's in the AFI Top 100, yeah. You need to understand kind of where the movie was at just as part of our history and culture in 1977 and what the work of, you know, John Dykstra and Phil Tippett and, mm-hmm. Dennis Muren.
And Marsha Lucas.
And Marcia Lucas, well, and all of them. I mean, everyone at ILM, all the visual effects people. Yeah, and of course, Norman Reynolds.
Oh, yes.
John Mollow and all those people. What they actually achieved on the screen was a modern miracle in 1977.
That's true. And the historical preservation argument does make the most sense to me.
You've never seen it.
Yeah,
right?
That's
true. You don't know, like, look at how they solved that problem. You know, look at how they solved that problem. Look at what they did with photochemical, you know, during the photochemical era, before any digital, before any color timing. Look at what they actually shot and released to the world that changed the world.
Wow, that's...
You can't see that.
That's
right?
True.
So if... Yeah, so, and what I've also found is the fear of releasing that is like, well, that's an imperfect version. Well, it's like, okay, but what we've learned is that people will never stop watching the Blu-ray version. They'll never stop watching the special edition version, right?
Yeah.
They Star Wars fans want, give me all the things, right? Give me all the versions, right?
That's so
and
true.
If you do that, the vitriol kind of disappears. You know, it's you know, I think the thing that you're reacting to is tell a Star Wars fan they can't have it and they want it more than anything else, right? You know, in a lot of ways, you know, the special editions, you could argue, are empirically better. But that's not, it's not an empirical argument. It's an emotional argument on top of a historical argument.
Well,
right.
And the interesting thing about this story, and I think you make the case very well, especially when it comes to this particular project, because my sort of emotional reaction to the idea of releasing the film is sort of the despecialized edition crowd, and the idea of, well, we want to keep all of the good changes, aka the full HD restoration and the Blu-ray quality and resolution of the film. But, well, you know, we're just not going to do that. Whereas this one is a little bit different. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
But that's not quite right. The despecialized edition was using Blu-ray elements, but was doing its best to color correct it back to the original color palette of the original. The only reason they were using Blu-rays because they didn't have any HD reference for certain shots. They had to Frankenstein things together, right? They weren't. In other words, when the movie came out, movies projected on film are high resolution by nature because they're analog.
That's true.
Right? So there's nothing more high def than an analog film print of a movie. There's no Blu-ray, there's no 4K on earth that ever matches, you know, because it's light going through a negative. You can, if, you know, with a powerful enough projector with enough lumens, you can broadcast it, you know, on the side of the Titanic if you want, right? It's analog, right? So the original Star Wars in any movie that came out is more high definition than any digital, you know, capture of that, right? So Star Wars, when it's released to home video, is put on what is available commercially at the time, which is VHS, right? Which is extremely low definition, right? It's video. It's, you know, it's bars of video. Laserdisc comes out, extremely low definition, you know, and then even DVD was just the Laserdisc version. So there is no high definition transfer of the original available until this 35 millimeter shows up. Now, what's really unfortunate about it is, you know, I think I'm very anti-piracy. I'm very I'm very much into the, you know, the rights of the artist. I'm very much into monetize things like music, movies, video games. Otherwise, I don't have a career, right? The truth is that if you put out, like Blade Runner put out a Blu-ray, and I don't know if you know much about Blade Runner, but Blade Runner has a gazillion different versions to it, right?
Okay.
And so the Blade Runner Blu-ray has four different versions of the movie on it. Four. Because Ridley Scott kept changing it. But he put them all out so people can choose, right? I don't see any harm in that in Star Wars. I mean, the fact is that the 2004 DVD of Return of the Jedi, for example, versus the Blu-ray from 2012 are different movies, you know? I like them both. I want to see them both. I can, you know, but that's just kind of the nature of those things. That's my take on it. And I think that's why fans are so passionate about it.
Indeed.
You know, what I don't like, though, and I agree with you on this, Riley, I don't like the anger. I don't like the George Lucas ruined my childhood. In fact, I'm very much against that. I think it's silly. You know, I mean, let's put these problems in perspective with what we're given.
Yeah.
I think that's a valid point. I think there is a valid point hidden in there that's worthy of discussion. Otherwise, you know, the amount of work that they had to put into this just wouldn't have taken place.
Yes. No.
I mean, it's an incredible undertaking.
Yeah, it is, and this what this group kind of nebulously called Team Negative did find an original 35mm print. We've kind of danced around the story a little bit, but an original 35mm print of the Star Wars film, and they've spent years cleaning this up, scanning it frame by frame, and it really does seem to be a work of love. And they've been the story doesn't explicitly state here on the Gizmodo story that I'm looking at, but I'll just quote it straight from here. It says, due to the highly dubious legality of releasing the restoration, they've remained relatively quiet about putting the restored version online. But it has started seeding its way through the internet in the last month or so. Which is, and that's one of those things where it's kind of a shame because it's not available commercially, but I honestly don't really know how I feel about it.
Yeah,
As a person who's never seen this, I want to see it just as almost an academic exploration.
I think it's a wonderful. I think if anything, if you're a fan of Star Wars and you're a fan of George Lucas, it's a wonderful insight into something that George Lucas achieved at the age of 30.
Yes.
Like if you watch it, you just go, you know what? This is what he made. If anything, it'll give you an appreciation of what the world saw, what changed the world, you know. Mm-hmm. Not that you can't with the special editions, but like this was what everybody saw, you know. That there's huge, I think, not just cultural significance and historical significance, but I think as a fan, there's a huge significance to, you know, this movie almost broke us. It almost killed George. It put him in the hospital.
Yep.
Look at what he achieved. And I think that that's so important and so valuable. You know, it is a highly dubious thing to support, but I understand why it exists. And as someone that just loves Star Wars, I would love to be able to see all those different versions and compare and contrast because that's part of the fun.
Yeah, no, it's so true. It's so true. Well, let's hit one final story before we get ready to roll out of here. And that is, some good Disney news. Not the they're shuttering Star Wars Weekends news. We're actually hearing some nice stuff from Disney World. They're announcing a new Star Wars themed entertainment. In fact, straight from the story here on comingsoon.net, and we'll have the link in the full link in the show notes. But just in time for this spring, coming very soon, with the April 4th arrival, there will be new Star Wars live entertainment experience at Disney World. It's going to be Star Wars, A Galaxy Far, Far Away, and a menacing First Order procession at Disney's Hollywood Studios will kick off the summer, and the park is launching a new nightly fireworks and projection show called Star Wars Galactic Spectacular that will eclipse anything done of its kind in the park's history. And I am very excited to see Star Wars expanded, because of course we're waiting for waiting patiently, or maybe not so patiently, for the grand Star Wars land. But in the meantime, we're going to have Star Wars A Galaxy Spectacular, which makes me very excited and wishing that I was going to Disney this summer instead of Europe. But I hear there are other things happening this summer in Europe, so we'll get to that in a second.
There is another thing, yes, in Europe this summer.
But David, I've got to say, a little bird told me that the grand good friend of the show, Jimmy Mack from Rebel Force Radio, is doing their grand listener meetup. We've participated the last 2 years, always a good time. I will not be able to be there this year, but I hear that someone considerably more knowledgeable about John Williams will be. And that you'll be at Disney, so I guess you're looking forward to this.
I am, yes, yeah. I'm fortunate enough. My wife and I are going to go to Florida and do a Rebel Force Radio meetup with everybody. Anyone that can come, I'd love to see folks there. I don't know if I'm not supposed to announce that. I have no idea, but I'm excited.
No, I just heard it on the podcast this week, so no worries. You're safe.
Oh, good. I'm glad that they said something. Oh, yeah, we're definitely excited about it, and. You know, really, really grateful for Jimmy and Jason for inviting me out and inviting my family out. And I can't wait to meet people. We did a listener meetup in Anaheim for Celebration that was just fantastic. And I can't wait to do that again. And honestly, go on some rides.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've been to Disney World. So this should be a lot of fun.
Yes, no, absolutely. It's and again, I can't wait till we actually can have drinks at the Mos Eisley Cantina, along with Chewbacca the Squeak Toy.
You can hear him in the background still.
It wouldn't be a Star Wars Report podcast without it. I like to have, if people who listen to the program know that I like to make recurring jokes out of anything I can, and the Chewbacca squeak toy is one that definitely has to stay. Whenever, like, prepare, whenever you come on the program, sir, it might, may or may not be brought up.
That's funny.
Oh, man.
I'll see if I can get him to look at me here.
Oh.
Yep, I just took a picture, so I'll post it. I'll tweet it at you at the Star Wars Report.
Done. Do it. All right. Well, folks, we do have one last thing to do.
It was a lot to me.
It's Boba's bounty.
As you wish.
Folks, each week we like to highlight something in the Star Wars community that that needs the word got out about it. It's something that we enjoy, whether it's a podcast or a movie or a new video game, a fan project. We like to highlight things each week, and I'll jump for mine, David, while you come up with yours, and we'll do our each Boba's bounty. This week, I'd like to highlight one of the nicest guys I've ever had the pleasure of meeting. It's Mr. James Arnold Taylor, of course, the voice of Obi-Wan to you Clone Wars fans and Star Wars Rebels fans, but just an overall super, super talented voice actor. And he's always connected in various ways to the Star Wars fan community. And what he's been doing the last few weeks are these really, really cool vlogs that chronicle his life as a voice actor. So if you go to YouTube and you search for James Arnold Taylor and find his channel, you're going to find the last few weeks he's really been putting out some really cool information on his daily life as a voice actor. And it's really fun and entertaining. If you've ever been to his shows at Disney or if you've liked his work as Obi-Wan, that's something that I highly, highly, highly recommend. Again, that's the JAT Vlogs, James Arnold Taylor's video blogs. You been doing anything Star Wars recently, Mr. Collins?
Well, obviously The Force Awakens, Star Wars Battlefront I was involved in as well. I did have to be one of the voice directors on that.
I'm going to totally rudely interject and just say, I only got, I obtained a PS4 and Battlefront about 2.5 weeks ago, and I just hit level 24.
Oh, good for you. That's fast.
I know. I may or may not have been. I think, and this is saying something to you guys, again, to call back, I've probably logged more hours now on Star Wars Battlefront than I did Star Wars Battlefront Renegade Squadron on the PSP. And that's saying something, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, so Star Wars Battlefront, if you get to level 40 and you unlock the Sullustan, that's my voice.
I'm on my way, sir. I'm on my way.
Other than that, I want to give a shout out to a guy that helped me do the comlink for a long time. And there's a guy named J.C. Reifenberg. He is a huge Star Wars fan. And he directed a short film that was produced actually by James Arnold Taylor to tie it in, called Summer 78. Did you get a chance to see that?
Oh, we had him on the show when that was released, but it's been a while.
Oh, good. Okay, well, then I'll have to bounty something else.
No, because it's so good. If you haven't seen it, you have to see Summer 78.
Yeah, and I did the music edit and the sound effects and mix on that as well.
No, JC's the man. In fact, you know what? This pick this week is entirely just the man, JC Reifenberg, because he's been a longtime friend of ours here. We worked with him a bit at Celebration Anaheim, and of course, he was on the show way, way, way back in the day. I met him originally at Star Wars Fan Days in Dallas when he premiered Hughes the Force.
Hughes the Force. I was going to say director of Hughes the Force, yeah.
Yes.
So JC's a good friend of mine, and he did it, wrote and directed a beautiful short film, and I want to talk to him and see if he'll submit it for the Fan Film Awards.
Yes.
Which is also an announcement that happened this week. That was probably going to be what I was going to highlight. But one of the things that I wanted to share with people is that a bunch of ex-LucasArts colleagues and I are working at a company now together, and our iPad game, and it's more than just a game, I'll explain in a second, was featured on the Today Show yesterday.
Oh, nice.
And the reason it was featured on the Today Show is because we're actually partnering, and we're working with this group of neuroscientists and this medical company in Boston called PureTech. And it's now in trials for FDA clearance with the FDA to treat ADHD. It's actually something that we're working on. And I wrote an entire orchestral score for it. and you know, did some sound work and things like that. Something that we're still working on, to basically start rolling out software and video games as potentially medicine. Certainly as a diagnostic tool, but I mean literally as medicine
to
flex and practice your brain for whatever interference training you needed, whether it be ADHD or maybe other things. It was covered on the show specifically because of the work that a specific neuroscientist, Dr. Adam Ghazali, was doing or is doing for you know, dementia and maybe potentially Alzheimer's, you know, early signs of that. There's all kinds of applications for the type of science that's behind the game, but it's really, really fascinating. And it's something that I'm very excited about. If people are curious about it, they can read about it. The company's called Achille Interactive. And the chief creative officer is actually the lead artist from Star Wars The Force Unleashed, Matt Omernick.
Oh, nice. That's that is amazing. Achille Interactive. That's, man, David, honestly, that hits close to home, that my grandmother suffers from dementia. And like that really, man, it really hits home because it's such such an issue with so many families. I will definitely, if you don't mind, in the Skype chat at some point or after we log off here, we'll definitely get the link so I can put that out on our Twitter and out on our on the show notes for this podcast episode as well.
Absolutely. No, I'd love that. And it's something that I've really signed up for to continue working on in the future with them. And it's, Matt Omernick from LucasArts, Adam Piper from LucasArts, who was one of the designers also on The Force Unleashed, worked with him all the way back on Bounty Hunter and Republic Commando. Those guys started this company and, you know, I was lucky enough to jump on board and we're hopefully making games that will eventually be used to, you know, to help people out. And that's the thing that is the most exciting part about it, you know. And it's funny how that, you know, we all met under working for George Lucas.
That is amazing. A man very much involved in charitable giving. That's amazing. And definitely, I can't wait to get the word out about it. And I couldn't think of a better way to cap off this week's episode of the Star Wars Report podcast. It has been episode 210. Stick around for just a moment. We'll give you guys all the links to follow us in a moment. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. It's been, man, what a week. What an amazing time. David, thank you so much for being a part of the show this week. And not just, and honestly, I thought it would be like a bit of music nerdery, and it certainly was that. But you bring such better perspective to Star Wars that I just can't give. As a member of the prequel generation, you really shed some insight on not just Star Wars The Force Awakens in context of the saga, but also just shed some light on Star Wars the original version. And one of these days, man, fingers crossed, we'll actually finally get to see an official release of that original version.
You know, I hope so too, and thank you so much for saying that. But I will say, man, prequel generation, stay strong forever.
Perfect.
Because, you know, as a LucasArts guy and as a Lucasfilm guy, the prequel generation was, you know, we were making games for everybody, but I worked on a ton of prequel games. The prequels are near and dear to my heart. And, you know, as the classic trilogy is, as I said, Star Wars is for everyone. And you know, I'm glad that, you know, this new era of Disney can potentially bring balance to the Force and bring Star Wars fans together as we always should be.
I think it is in an incredible way, in an incredible way. Folks, you can follow David on Twitter. He's at David W. Collins, and he's very interactive on there. I can speak from personal experience, and so make sure that you hit him up. And also Star Wars Oxygen, the single best Star Wars podcast about any subset of Star Wars topics. It is the most in-depth, academically rigorous, and fun Star Wars podcast out there. And so if you're not listening to Star Wars Oxygen, what are you doing with your life? Go home and rethink your life, in the great words of Obi-Wan. And David, anything else you'd like to let folks know about before we get ready to sign off?
No, I think you covered it. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for being a part of the Star Wars Report. You can follow the Star Wars Report on Twitter. It's at Star Wars Report, Facebook/Star Wars Report. And then I'm also on Twitter personally. I'm at The Riley Guy, where you can find me. And I'm on there all the time tweeting up a storm. You can also email the show, StarWarsReport@gmail.com, and help us out if you think you recognize that Attack of the Clones cue. If you think that's from Attack of the Clones, or if it's maybe another version of it, maybe we'll have our own little exploration. But I have a feeling it will pale in comparison to what David has in store on Star Wars Oxygen. So it was a fun exercise. Folks, we'll catch you next week on the Star Wars Report. Make sure that you can catch us live. And if you want to jump in on the old SWR tip jar, of course, you can contribute at patreon.com/Star Wars Report. We do appreciate those of you who are making this show happen each and every week. That does it. So long, folks. Remember, many Bothans died to bring you this podcast.
Many Bothans died to bring you this podcast.
That's an episode. All right, I'm going to shut off the live stream. Everybody in the chat, thanks so much for joining us. We'll catch you next week, same time, same place.
Thank you.
All right, so we are off air, and man, David, that was incredible. Thank you so much, and I'll tell you what, man.